is Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Bunganyi. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Experts say that African design elements have significantly shaped global trends, inspiring both fashion and interior spaces worldwide. However, according to Nasozika Kembo, the author of the new book, The African Decor Edit, Collecting and Decorating with Heritage Objects, mainstream design has often overlooked the cultural depth and historical significance behind these elements. She tells me that African interior design is more than just a visual style. It's a celebration of identity, tradition, and craftsmanship that transforms spaces with authenticity. She joins me in studio to talk about her new book, in which she shares the artistry of African decor, the importance of honoring the contributions of artisans, and her mission to advocate for transparency and respect in sourcing of heritage items. Nasozika Kembo, thank you so much for joining us today here at the Voice of America. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, Jackson.
You've been traveling. You've been all over the world in the last couple of days. How are you feeling? You just arrived back from Berlin.
Not too jet-lagged.
Yeah, not
somehow.
Too jet-lagged. You look fine. You look good.
Thank you.
First time I saw you a couple of weeks ago, you told me about your book, and I went online and bought the book right away.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Because I think it's a very necessary book. I'm also very much interested in the subject matter. But thanks for putting together this book. Talk to us about why you decided that you had to create this work. Why is it important? What gap does it fill in the design world?
Absolutely. I wrote this book and intend for this book to fill a gap around the full stories and profiles of the artisans and the artists in Africa who create so many of the decorative objects that we've come to love and know very well, both inside of the continent, but also outside of the African continent, primarily in the United States, in Europe, even as far away as Australia, where in that distribution and in that dissemination, some of the story gets lost along the way. And in working closely with so many artisans over the years through XN Studio, my home decor brand, I was getting to know these artisans and their stories on an intimate level and wanted to be able to share what I knew with my customer base, essentially, and getting to know customers and clients better over the years. I knew there was an appetite and a desire for them to know more. Mm-hmm. Social media and newsletters and even product descriptions were not ample enough platforms for me to be able to build out that story. And I found a book was the best way and the most effective way to preserve the story, document the story, and write the story, because mm-hmm. you can't get rid of a book with the click of a switch when social media decides to have a meltdown.
So let's talk about the process of the book. How did you put together the book? How did you select? You traveled a couple of countries.
Right.
Talk to us about the process itself.
Yes. So in total, there are 9 African countries that are in the book, a total of 13, if you include the range of home interiors as well. And I traveled to the majority of the countries. I worked with a combination of contributors on the ground, photographers on the ground in countries where I couldn't go to for logistical reasons or mm-hmm. because I had commitments and obligations back home. Fortunately, I'm a photographer as well, so I completed about 2/3 to 3/4 of the photographs myself and then collaborated with other very talented and professional photographers around the continent as well to fully bring the storytelling visually, the visual storytelling to life.
The visual aspect is quite important because,
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you. And so part of it was even to show photographically, to tell the story photographically and document it photographically in a way that had not been done before as far as I had seen. And I completed and did a lot of pre-research to make sure that the vision that I had didn't exist yet, or I was so hungry. I was really looking for it because I wanted to see us visualized and portrayed in an elevated way, crisp, clear images, thoughtful, intimate subjects and contact matters visually, and didn't quite find that in the manner and in the volume which I wanted to produce it in. So I said, okay, I'm the person to do it.
Absolutely. That's your calling.
That's my calling. Yes. That's what I'm here to do.
Yeah.
So I focused I prioritize geographic regions as opposed to countries because I believe that, especially with the arts and objects, our cultures, our languages, they predate what we consider and
the
call
borders.
The borders, yes. And the geopolitical borders, yeah. Which I also acknowledge very clearly in the beginning and then in the introduction of the book, and then I put it aside because I believe that we are supra border, geopolitical border.
Absolutely.
And as you can even see here, these are examples of objects that are common to the lakes region of East Africa. These baskets are in Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, Kenya. Mm. So we can't say that these are from Uganda.
Yes.
I happen to go to Uganda because I have family and that's where my artisans are there. But I'm very, very clear about the fact that our objects and identities are bigger and go beyond borders. Mm. So I focused on 5 geographic regions of the continent and within those curated and selected artisans to meet.
What was the criteria for the artisans? You were these people that you had worked with previously, or some people you researched and decided to go. But also, I see that there are some homes that are already set up. Did you set up these homes and then you take the pictures?
How did
you go about the process?
Good question. Mm. I'll start with the last question first. All of the homes were as is. I didn't style. They were homes that I, and people in the same sense with the artists, and some of them I knew already and had relationships with, and some of them I didn't. So Jody in Brooklyn, she was my neighbor for many years. Talea in North Carolina, we had been following each other on Instagram for many years and had kind of struck up a rapport there. So I'd actually never met her in person, but reached out to her via Instagram, and she was thrilled to participate. I slid in her DMs.
Yeah.
So there was a range. Anahita in Berlin, I think I found her home on Pinterest. She had been featured in Architectural Digest Germany. And I was curating initially based on the aesthetics, but also home residents who had a story behind a relationship, a story behind the objects, either something interesting in terms of how they sourced it or whether they had a cultural connection to it. But I wanted to present the range of relationships to African decor. So that was the criteria for the residents. And then in terms of the artisans, similarly, some of them I worked with for many years. Others, they were artisans of friends. My friend Hana Getachew, whose London home is in the book, but also her artisans in Addis Ababa. She introduced me to her artisans and connected me with her team there, which was such a gift because I had full access and already had been, we'd both kind of been mutually vetted. And so the meeting was all initially and automatically very intimate and felt close. And there was a level of trust there that we had thanks to our connection, our mutual connection, Hana.
Yeah.
And in other instances in Cameroon, I went there and had no connection, no clue, and in good old African word of mouth. That's how it works.
Yes.
And that is how Cameroon worked. That is exactly how it worked.
Yeah.
So they were
check out this person.
Down the road.
They
make a left at the, you know.
The mango tree.
Yep. No exaggeration.
You brought with you to the studio a couple of objects, I assume. Tell us about these objects.
Yes. Yeah. So
where do we place them geographically?
Absolutely. Mm. So the reason I brought these two in particular as a juxtaposition, which I mentioned, briefly a few minutes ago, that demonstrate how objects and our cultures and our innovation really traverse borders. So this is made in Uganda by my artisan group there with Judith and Agnes. And these traditionally are larger, and they're called ebibo. Mm. And we carry them during wedding ceremonies. And as you know, in East Africa, that's a common
absolutely
accessory for wedding ceremonies.
I'm from Rwanda, we do exactly
the same thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. And, you know, you have the tall ones, the agaseke, you stack them, etc. And this is more of a contemporary version of this basket. This is actually made in Rwanda. This is the brighter sisal, which is very common there. This is made from raffia. Mm. And this is a trivet. So this is, you put, you know, your warm plates on this on the table so it doesn't scorch the table. So this is a much more contemporary adaptation of what we have originally...
Of the Echibo.
Yeah. Exactly. But again, these are common throughout the lakes region, so we can't say, okay, these are...
They belong to one group,
but the way we're always moving around naturally.
Ours is a story of migration and intermarriages.
So that's what I also love behind the stories that our objects inherently have to tell. And that is, those are the stories that I wanted to bring to the fore and to document as an alternative to these rigid borders that actually don't carry much weight.
In case you're just joining us, this is Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. We are chatting with Nasozi Kakembo, author of the new book, The African Decor Edit, Collecting and Decorating with Heritage Objects. Let's take a quick break and listen to some of your responses to our question of the week. The question was, what are your views on the cost of education in your country? This is what you said.
When you look at the cost that we get this education at, it is very alarming. For example, me as a student, the amount of money we pay is always very high, and the parents are always complaining about the tuition because it's too expensive and high for them, and you know it's not good for me because first of all, the books we need at university are very expensive themselves. We get these ourselves, we have to buy them by our own selves, and this means that on top of the tuition which you pay, which is very high, we are buying textbooks. Now this is a very burden on my parent.
Education is expensive because as of now, people paying a lot of money. For example, in some of the secondary schools, they are saying that this coming January, the fees will raise and will come in 12,000. So the people, they cannot afford to pay such kind of money.
For instance, last year, examination fee we were paying 2,700, but now it has been raised to 6,000, which is just showing that education is now expensive.
Many thanks to all of you for sharing your opinions to our question of the week. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. Let's continue with our conversation with Nasozi Kakembo, the author of the new book, The African Decor Edit, Collecting and Decorating with Heritage Objects. Nasozi is talking to us about the process of putting together the book and how showcasing African design and design elements in interior design can contribute to a larger conversation about representation and cultural appreciation in the design world.
I'm curious now, but I want to jump ahead a little bit.
Yeah.
What kind of stories would the objects in your home tell?
Wow. The objects in my home would tell the story of my family's migration and my family's movement, which starts, my mother is African-American, born in Texas, spent the first few years of her life in Georgia, and then her family migrated to Boston, Massachusetts as part of the Great Migration of Black Americans in the 40s. And then she went to university.
The movement up north.
Her father worked, and my grandfather worked in a Ford factory. It was the first one opened in Somerville, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And then she went to university in Hampton in Virginia. And then about 2 or 3 years in, she left during the civil rights era and moved to Germany, where it was more peaceful and safe. Mm-hmm. And she could really live as a free Black woman in Europe, as opposed to
the United States, which is the irony.
And my father, around the same time, he was also moving.
James Baldwin really writes succinctly about that.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So she was part of that whole movement in her own way. And my father was moving from Uganda, where he went to Makerere University, and there was also political turmoil there at that time. So he went to the UK as a political refugee, continued his studies there, and then had an opportunity in Germany. So he was in the UK for about 5 years, then went to Germany where he met my mother, where she was by that time. And so they've all collected pieces.
And they moved to the U.S. together.
And then they moved to the U.S. together. So this is where that chapter in our family starts. But there were so many years and so many movements before that. But I have a lot of furniture even and art and objects that my mother collected along the way. She was, even when she was living in Germany, she was traveling to Africa quite a bit during the 60s and 70s and 80s before it was this, you know, thing you do on Instagram.
Right. Post-colonial Africa.
Post-colonial. And also there was still that bit of that energy of optimism.
Yes,
and there was a very unique moment in time that she experienced there as an American or Afropean living in Europe at that time. And my father would travel
the stories
back.
She must be telling.
Yeah, they're
wow.
They're incredible. So then when my father would travel to Uganda and bring back, he was usually bringing back the baskets.
Yes.
He would bring back the baskets. He would bring back our impala hides. Mm. And so that is essentially what my home looks like now with my own twist on it.
Let's talk a little bit about ethical consumption of these heritage items.
Yes.
I know people, you know, tourists or Americans or Europeans go to Africa and just buy these items without knowing fully the story behind them. What do you usually advise people who are trying to collect these items for their homes?
Yes.
About a deeper story that is just not just the aesthetic of the object.
Absolutely. So first and foremost, I think knowing that awareness and education about the object, what it's about, and that can either take place in, you know, if you are traveling in the context of that that type of sourcing, speaking with the vendor, getting to know their story a little bit better. And I believe that is part of the travel experience. That is why we spend, you know, thousands of dollars to go to different countries, is to really meaningfully engaging with the authenticity of the spaces that we're entering as foreigners, whether that's me going to Mexico for a long weekend or me going to Tunisia, where, you know, I'm not from, but really taking the time to ask the questions in the same way that we scrutinize our consumer habits with our local goods here in the United States, for example. So when we're going to the grocery store, we're looking at labels. There are labels there now. We want to know the percentage of, you know, sodium, and if the product is organic. So transferring that curiosity and transferring that intentionality into the consumer goods and into the goods that we're purchasing when we are outside of our everyday routine is really what I want us to be able to adapt and to become second nature in the way that it is already and increasingly becoming part of our ethical consumer phenomenon and lifestyle here in the United States and in the West, and transferring that to other objects.
Absolutely. Now, we know that African design has long influenced aesthetics, you know, global aesthetics, from fabrics like Ankara, mud cloth, kente. They are celebrated worldwide.
Exactly.
We know they have influenced designers like Christian Dior, Louis Vuitton. But what do you think has been overlooked or misunderstood about African decor in mainstream interior design?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jackson. Thank you for that. What I believe has been overlooked is the inherent value and the value of those objects from the hands of the artisans all the way through the entire end-to-end production and supply chain, from the moment that they're made to the retailer. And what I'm often finding is that whether it's with fashion, whether it's with music, whether it's with film and home decor, which is our focus of the discussion here today, the objects become more valuable the further they get away from the hands of the origin or the country of origin. And that needs to be reversed. There is a lot of value that's lost due to lack of intellectual property rights, which is a whole nother sphere of what I'm working on behind the scenes. But that's what's missing. It's really the value, and in that value is the economic opportunity and the wealth creation that these objects can foster for the communities of origin, for the artisans, and more broadly for the countries and the local economies that they originate from.
Mm. What other trends, I guess, aside from yesterday I had to explain to somebody about Afro-minimalism and Afro-futurism.
Yes, yes. So many things now.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we're taking off.
Which other design trends do you feel are bringing African aesthetics into a broader spotlight?
Yeah, that's also a fun question. Yeah. And it connects in a way to your previous question.
Yeah.
I hadn't gotten a chance to Google this yet, but when when I thought about this question before, Afro luxury popped into my mind.
Oh, I love that.
Is that
yes,
a thing?
I love it.
Should we copyright that today?
Yes.
We're creating it today. So Afro luxury, these objects, and as you will find in the book, and as you have seen in the book, they take weeks to produce. They take knowledge that has been passed down for generations and centuries. They take a highly skilled level of expertise, which are three of the attributes that we do associate with luxury. LVMH and some of the others that we mentioned, they've been branded luxury, but in fact, they have a cultural IP or an intellectual property, but they're produced by machines, by and large, and we don't know who's making them. But their value...
Made in China.
Right? So their value was just bestowed upon them, and now we are all believing that these are luxury items. But defining another form of luxury, and I think that the African creative market and the African creative sector can be and should be the brokers of that, and really... begin that entire movement of Afro luxury because I believe that our cultures, our objects are inherently luxurious.
Absolutely. And find a way of codifying some of these intellectual property laws.
Yes.
I like you said something, cultural IP.
Absolutely.
Love that. I think that's a beautiful word.
Thank you.
So what do you want readers to take away from this book?
Yeah. So there are a few things that I would like readers to take away from this book. If we visualize an onion, I'm meeting people where they are with this book. So if somebody just wants beautiful ideas for how to decorate with baskets, or new ideas for arranging different types of African furniture in their home, then that's what I want them to take away from it. If they want a deeper understanding of how they can support artisans more directly through their purchases and ethical and intentional sourcing, I spell that out in the ethical sourcing framework so they know how to go about that in a way that their dollars will have the maximum impact and in the way that is intended. And furthermore, and last but not least, I want a shift around the perception of value of African cultures, people, and objects. And I want that shift to have a direct and beneficial impact on livelihoods and wealth creation on the continent. And I believe that the African creative industry and sector and innovation have a significant role to play in transforming the economies one by one, but also at the same time throughout the entire continent of Africa.
I love that. So as a third culture kid, I assume, and this might be true, that you have a family home back in Uganda, right?
Yes.
I'm curious to know who decorated that home.
That's
and if you've been tempted
so
to redecorate it, and what kind of objects would you find there?
So I'm laughing because somebody asked me that question in London last week.
Yes.
And my dad was there in the audience, and he's the one who decorated. We have two homes.
So you do have a home.
We have two homes. Okay. One is in the city, and one is the ancestral home.
The village home. They call it the village home. Yes.
So I'm like, okay, that home is going to do what it needs to do. That's been around for centuries, decades, at least 60, 70 years before I came around. The home in the city is a bit newer, and my dad has decorated that.
Oh. So your dad has you might have taken this from your dad in many ways.
No, but he hasn't used any of my objects.
Oh, no.
So every time I'm able to go back, I leave something from something local, on the side. And
so
then when I return,
when I return,
he's moved it. So we're working on that. But I'm now working on a line of furniture to replace some of the made-in-China objects he's accessorized the home with. But we have beautiful, beautiful wood artisans, one of which is in the book. Amisi is in the book. But we have beautiful wood. We have beautiful natural resources in East Africa. And there's a beautiful tradition of wood carving and furniture making. So one by one, I'll be swapping out pieces. It's happening.
I don't know what his reaction was since he was in the audience.
Exactly.
But I know he's going to be watching this.
Yes, exactly.
But you're coming for his home.
I'm coming yes.
Let's talk a little bit more about the whole made in China, because I've seen it everywhere on the continent, this replication of cultural items. What does that mean for the local artisans you work for, and what is their reaction when they see these type of objects?
Right. So the reaction is, it's quite a sad reaction. It's heartbreaking, in fact. And what is taking place, you know, we will call a spade, it's piracy, and it's design theft. And again, that brings us to the cultural intellectual property discussion, cultural intellectual rights property discussion. Mm. And there, you know, when I was preparing my notes and for Cameroon, even though I didn't have my interviewee set up yet, I still had my notes. And one of the objects and one of the reasons why I was so eager to go to Cameroon is because one of their most beautiful and prized objects, their Bamileke stools, have been completely stolen and pirated by a US-based company. Big, massive company, lots of, you know, revenue, high-end interior designers sourced from them. And I first came across this object, I think, in one of the high-end magazines years ago. And they call this stool the Bamileke stool. So I was curious.
They even took the name.
Wow. I mean, this is egregious. This isn't just like a subtle phenomenon. And so in doing my research, I looked, and this is one thing that we can also do as ethical consumers, but look into the product details online if you are shopping online, as so many of us do these days. Look on the product details, the product descriptions, and if it's the information is vague or if it just says imported, that's a red flag, because if something is generally from the country of origin, it will celebrate that fact.
Absolutely.
And it should celebrate
Absolutely.
That fact, and that is an obligation and an opportunity for the seller to state that very clearly. So I was already a little bit skeptical, or very skeptical, because the product description said imported. So then I went the extra step and I reached out to customer service and I asked them, this is imported. Where is this object made? Where is this Bamileke stool made? And they got back to me. And I didn't write them, you know, in anger
an
or
angry
anything.
Letter. Yeah,
just out of curiosity as a potential customer.
Yeah.
And they very promptly and kindly got back to me and told me it was made in the Philippines.
Wow.
So.
And you're like, there are no Bamileke people in the Philippines.
Last I checked, that wasn't a migration pattern. That didn't happen. So I printed out the conversation. I printed out the listing and everything for my folder and showed my artisan, Honoré, when I was doing the interview. And I don't think there was not a photograph that made it into the book, but I have a photograph, and it's also just imprinted in my mind of his expression when he saw that.
Yeah.
And it was so heartbreaking. So taking that heartbreak, and I'm taking that frustration and channeling it into the advocacy and channeling it into securing their rights so that they can really prosper. And so we can really assert the value for that their objects deserve.
And you say your role, or our role as ethical consumers, is to ask that extra question: is where is this product from?
Where is it from? That's a first and easy step. Where is it from?
Yeah. Before I let you go, we are playing. We introduced a new segment on our show where we play a game. We call it This or That African Edition.
Okay.
And since you're here with us, with your beautiful book, The African Decor, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions.
Fine, okay.
We'll see where you fall on this.
Oh, boy.
All right, let's start with the most popular one. Afrobeats or High Life or Bongo Flava, since you're from East Africa. You have East Africa connection.
For that one, I'll have to say High Life.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I actually grew up listening to a lot of High Life.
Interesting.
And I knew of, you know, High Life before Afrobeats, obviously, but...
Salute to you.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
My auntie Elaine would often play High Life at home during holidays.
All right, and you love to travel. We talked about how you just came back from a trip in Europe.
Yes.
Of course, talking about your book, but you travel around the continent. So, safari in Kenya or diving in Zanzibar?
Diving in Zanzi.
Yeah?
Yeah, I've done safari a couple of times. I haven't gone diving yet in the Indian
Ocean. Is that on your bucket list?
It is now. It is now.
Thank you so much for playing our game. Nasozika Kembo,
thank
you so much. The author, The African Decor Edit. Such a pleasure to meet you and to read your book. And I hope everybody checks it out.
Me too.
And this is the Ekibo.
Yes.
Which also has not only just a decorative value, but also you can leave your keys in it or carry your fruit in it.
Absolutely.
Nasozi, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jackson. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
That was Nasozika Kembo, the author of the new book titled The African Decor Edit. You can watch the full interview on video at voaafrica.com or via our YouTube channel and on Facebook. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington.